Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. 5 weeks ago, a massive fire roared through the western half of the Columbia River Gorge, while hundreds of thousands of acres burned across the rest of Oregon and more than another million in Montana. This past week, massive wildfires erupted across far more populated areas in Northern California, causing record-breaking damage and loss of life. This morning, we'll talk about why this year's fire season in the West has been so intense, and is this a precursor of what is becoming the new normal? My guest is Dominic Della Sala, President and Chief Scientist at the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon, and a frequent guest here on Locus Focus. Dominic, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks. So good to be back on your show, Barbara. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell a little bit of the backstory to this show, because actually this morning we were supposed to have Richard Heimberg on, who is an expert on peak oil and creating a renewable future. So I emailed him last Monday to check in and confirm that he was going to be on, and I get an email back saying, I have no phone line, I have no internet, I have no Skype, my cell phone is spotty, I'll get back to you about whether I'll be able to make it. And then I remembered he lived in Santa Rosa. And then I got an email from his agent saying that he and his wife had evacuated. They were okay, but they were evacuated. So it seemed fitting to move Dominic up, who was supposed to be on the show next week, today to talk about the situation that Richard Heimberg is facing personally down there in Santa Rosa. And actually, Dominic, we've been talking about doing this show for a couple months, and we keep bouncing you around because I think actually the last time we bounced you off the air was because of the Eagle Creek fire had just broken out. So I just kind of want to throw this out to you as somebody who's talked a lot in the past about how wildfire is really important to our forest environments and probably to our grassland environments as well. What does this say to you that I keep moving you around because of all the wildfires that are happening this summer here in the West?
Well, yeah, I understand the need to move around, and I don't think the fire issue is going away. We've got to learn to get to coexistence with fires because they're increasingly becoming prevalent in our region as a result of increased human activity and also an increasing effect of climate change on how forests and other ecosystems are being affected by longer droughts and higher temperatures.
Well, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot, and actually I flashed on this when we were first supposed to talk, and when I was setting up the first show that I did about the Eagle Creek fire, and we have had many conversations where basically we say fire, good. But when the Eagle Creek fire was going on, there were a lot of us who were disconcerted, and we'll get in a little bit to how that fire probably is not so bad after all. But when we look at the fires that are going on in one country, California, it's very hard to say fire, good. And I remember getting an email from you, and I asked you how are you doing with the Checo Bar fire down your way in Ashland, and you described how horrible the air was and you know how nasty it was to be living in those conditions, which were very similar to what we were living with up here. So how do you reconcile the fact that it's really a challenge, it's more than a challenge, it can be life-threatening to live in an area which is being impacted by wildfire? I mean, even if you're not having to evacuate, even if your house isn't being burnt down, the kind of air quality that we've had throughout the West, and particularly throughout Oregon and Washington this summer, has been abominable. How do we reconcile that with the need for fires to burn?
Well, I think it's a classic human interest issue, and nobody likes to deal with smoke, and certainly the situation in Napa Valley and Santa Rosa is devastating to the people and the communities that have lost their homes and loss of life in that fire situation. And I think what we're looking at is the accumulation of bad decisions in terms of where we place homes and communities that have been really with us for many decades now, but in addition, we've got the climate change issue that's heating us up and causing fire seasons to last longer. So it really is a human issue problem. And, you know, in the case of where we've got incredible sprawl that has happened in a lot of Western communities, we now have 46 million homes living in fire-prone areas. So I have to ask the question, we don't build on top of volcanoes. Why do we continue to expand into fire sheds, knowing that eventually, no matter what we do, we're going to see fire in those ecosystems because that's what's happened historically, and we're going to see more of it in places because we've got climate change also causing our fire seasons to lengthen.
I was having a conversation yesterday with a good friend who lives in El Cerrito, and actually she lives right kind of at the beginning of the hills, the West Contra Costa County hills, and we were talking about, I was describing to her what you've said about the problems with building people living and building in fire-prone landscapes. And she said, well, where should everybody in Napa County and Sonoma County live? You know, where are they supposed to live if they can't live where they're living? So I thought that's a good question. I mean, at this point, we have all these people living in really fire-prone landscapes. And it used to be a problem much more in Southern California, because I remember when Santa Rosa was a small town back when I first came to the West Coast in 1970. And it was hard to imagine when I went back there maybe 25 years later and saw how much it had sprawled out. But where do people live in the West now if they can't live in fire-prone landscapes?
Yeah, I think that's an issue for everyone that's working on smart growth, and that we need to kind of sit down as communities and redesign our living space so that we're living in safe places. And, you know, this problem isn't going to go away. You know, those structures will be rebuilt, and maybe in another 10, 20, 30 years from now, we'll be dealing with a similar situation. In fact, the last big fire in the Napa Valley area was 1964 that had similar devastating effects on communities. There weren't quite as many houses at that time, but you know, we're going to build back in the same places, and we're going to face the same situation in the future because the fire issue isn't going away. And I think, in addition, we've got to work on home protection policies that deal with the existing homes and reducing their risk to fire by building with fire-resistant materials, clearing vegetation within about a 50 to 100 feet radius around the homes. So there are things that we can do to reduce the risk, but the more we build in these places, the more inevitable some sort of natural disaster is going to reset the clock, and you know, the next generation is going to be dealing with this problem as well.
Well, I've read a number of articles, particularly the ones I'm fascinated by, the ones in the Los Angeles Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, and they make a comparison between this living on a fire-prone landscape and constant living with fire in Southern California, which has been the way of life probably since the 1920s, compared to Northern California, where people didn't think of themselves, first of all, living on a fire-prone landscape, and didn't think of themselves as sprawling the way that Southern California has sprawled. And yet, in fact, what's been going on in Napa and Sonoma counties in particular, in Solano County, where the fires are the most concentrated, has been massive urban sprawl over the last probably 30 years. So one person was talking about how this makes us really have to rethink, you know, how we build, where we live, and stuff like that. However, later on in the article, the person sort of acknowledges, well, he mentioned the last fire, and actually he said the last fire there was 60 years ago, so he didn't know about the one that you were talking about in the 60s. But he said, well, but, you know, we'll rebuild and just go back to life as normal and forget about it till the next fire happens. So I'm wondering, how do we get out of that cycle where we just keep doing the same thing over and over again? And every time, I mean, if we just continue increasing populations in areas like Napa and Sonoma County, how next time it's going to be much worse than it was this time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, isn't that the definition of crazy? Keep doing it over and expecting a different outcome. I really think that partly, and I don't like to point fingers of blame, but I think part of the issue here is that every time smart growth ordinances come out, they either get voted down or opposed by local governments. And, you know, I think people need to start asking that question. Are we building in the right places? How can we work on smart growth ordinances to, you know, get more cluster development away from fire-prone areas? Maybe we don't build on south-facing slopes. Maybe we don't build in steep canyon areas that put firefighters at risk to defend homes in places that they should not be in the first place. So I really think we have to have an intelligent conversation about, you know, building in safe places and not just restarting the clock and expecting, you know, the next generation to deal with the same losses.
Well, speaking of smart growth, this is just a moment for us to pat ourselves on the back as Oregonians. One of the things I kept thinking about is like two of the three or four biggest fires in Oregon this year. Actually, let's talk about them all, because, I mean, the only fire that was close to an urban area in Oregon was the Eagle Creek Fire, and the other ones were all in pretty much wilderness areas, the one down by your way in Checo Bar, and then the Whitewater Fire by Mount Jefferson. And sure, we got a lot of smoke in our urban areas from these fires, but in particular, I kept thinking about the difference between the Eagle Creek Fire, which tore our guts out here in Portland. However, the reality of it was the number of people who had to evacuate was in the hundreds. There were a couple structures that were burnt down, and I don't think any of them were permanent homes. Nobody was killed. And we can get to a little bit while in a while how actually that fire might have been something that was much needed by the landscape. And I thought about that, and I'm thinking, and that fire burned within 20 miles of the city limits of Portland, or maybe even less. Here in Santa Rosa, Santa Rosa is 50 miles north of San Francisco. However, there is very little natural space between San Francisco and the outskirts of Santa Rosa. And I thought about how you have a city that sprawls as much as San Francisco does and sprawls into these what were once amazing wildlands and grassland savannas, which can be very fire prone, that those two images really depict to me the very difference between what happens when you do have land use planning like we've had in Oregon for, what is it now, 47 years or 44 years, whatever, and compare that with the very late start that California's had in trying to control the way that development happens.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Portland, although it also has growth issues, is a leader in terms of dealing with smart growth and having good ordinances in place. And I think in the situation with the Eagle Creek fire, because it was in a national scenic area, you didn't have as much development, therefore you didn't have the same situation with loss of structure and property and, you know, at risk, people would have been at risk if you had development in those areas. And I think one thing that we should probably spend a little bit of time talking about is that fire itself, even though it was caused by, you know, fireworks and was not a natural ignition, the pattern on the landscape was very beneficial. The problem now that we face is people like Representative Greg Walden are proposing a massive post-fire logging bill in one of the nation's premier national scenic areas. And, you know, nobody likes to look at clear cuts, but that's what Greg Walden is promoting as restoration, which, you know, he's rushing in with a logging bill when people really need to see some restoration happening by allowing that landscape to recover on its own and just, you know, allowing the natural recovery processes to take shape.
Actually, he reminds me of this sign I saw one time. I was driving out to British Columbia, I think about 15, 16 years ago, and I hadn't been up there in a long time, and I was really blown away as I was taking the ferries up along the Sunshine Coast and seeing all these clear cuts that hadn't been there in the 70s and early 80s. And then I get to off the second ferry and I start heading towards where I'm heading, and there's a big sign with Smokey the Bear saying, only you can prevent forest fires, and then I drove right into a clear cut. So that seems to be Walden's idea of how to prevent forest fires.
Yeah, and not only that, but in addition to just wrecking the National Scenic Corridor, it would occur in a portion of wilderness areas that overlap with the National Scenic Corridor. And by putting clear cuts on the landscape, you actually increase the chance that you're going to have an intense fire burning in that area the next time a fire occurs. Because everybody knows when you're starting a campfire, you use kindling, you use small materials. You don't put big logs on a fire to start it. So he's taking that. This would take out the big live and dead trees and replace them with flammable plantations and logging slash that would just give you the big fire event next time a fire happens in that canyon.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dominic Della Sala, who's president and chief scientist at the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon. And we're talking about why this wildfire season has been so intense and how we learn to live with wildfires and looking at the fact that wildfires are still a necessary part of the landscape. Let's talk, before we get back into the consequences of the fires that we're witnessing right now, let's talk about some of the reasons why these fires are occurring and why this wildfire season is so much more intense. And on the way in, I was hearing discussion about the inability of the Trump administration and much of the media to put the words climate change next to all the incredible hurricanes that have been happening on the East Coast. Is that the same problem here? Because one of the articles that you sent me, scientists are talking about how we can't blame climate change for any specific wildfire, but we can say that climate change is contributing to conditions that would encourage wildfires. So how far are we away from just saying this is the impact of climate change?
Well, I just actually was a witness at the hearing in the House Natural Resources Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations on September 29th. And then just last week, I did a science briefing in the Senate on this very topic. And so I think while we can't say one individual fire is being caused by climate change, we look at trends over time. And the trends that we're seeing in the scientific community is an increase in the length of the fire season from an average of 5 to 7 months. So we've added 2 more months onto the fire season, and in places we're seeing more prolonged droughts, higher temperatures. So when you get that combination of weather events caused by a change in climate, you've predisposed the landscape for increase in fire activity. Acres burning mostly are going up in recent decades, and that's what we're seeing in many places of the West. There's also the addition of the human element. And in fact, when you look at all the fires that are started nationwide, about 40,000 fires per year have a human cause to them. And so we have added fire ignitions as a result of more human activity on the landscape, more sprawl, more roads in our forests. That means more activity on the forest and an increase in fire starts. Like we saw in Eagle Creek, those fire starts are unnatural events and they add to our fire season. So it's both climate change and human activity that are mainly driving these changes in fire behavior that we're seeing in many places in the West.
Well, as far as the human activity goes, I mean, the one extreme, it's that kid who threw the firecracker into the gorge in Eagle Creek, which I consider malicious. I mean, and that's... That'll be like what we don't know, if and when he's going to be charged and what the circumstances will be. But it seems to me that that act in itself is somewhere between actually thoughtless, mindless, and somewhat malicious. However, I was reading about somebody was allegedly started a really big fire in California a number of years ago because his lawnmower sparked and it was very dry conditions. And actually, I think the guy went to jail for 2 years for arson. And I don't know why his lawnmower sparked, if it was negligence or on his part or what, but it seems like we need to be able to figure out, what kinds of education we need to do and then also what kinds of regulations we need that are enforceable so that, there was a fire that started right by the Oakland Zoo a couple nights ago from a car fire. Unfortunately, it was put out really quickly because they're pretty vigilant up there now in the East Bay Hills as far as not letting any fires get out of control. But there are so many things that human beings can do that range from being malicious to being just careless or to even being unconscious about stuff. How can that be controlled so that we do cause less fires?
Well, I think the best example that I can give you on this issue is seasonal road closure in the national forest. And when we have high fire activity, we need to be closing more roads. And in many cases, we need to be taking roads out because not only are they a source of fire ignition because you've got human activity along those roads, but those roads are also polluting streams with the chronic sediment that happens off of the road prism. So we've got to start looking at our transportation system in our national forest because I think that's the best place we can start looking at, having a more responsible road transportation plan.
Yeah, I've also thought about having gatekeepers at some of the really popular trails in the gorge. And I'm going to have somebody from Friends of the Gorge on next week to talk about the aftermath of the Eagle Creek fire, and we'll talk more about that then. But I just think about if there were the resources or whether there were volunteer organizations that could actually be at the trailheads. But I think about all the people who were stuck up at Eagle Creek when the fire started, and a lot of them were wearing bathing suits and flip-flops because they weren't intending to go more than 2 miles and go swimming in the pool, and they didn't expect to have to hike 14 miles out and spend the night in the woods. But that people need education so that they don't go into a wildland area in flip-flops and a bathing suit, even because you don't know what's going to happen. Like the kinds of precautions and protections and preparations people should take seriously before they go into the woods. And the same thing would be for people who are motoring in backwoods areas, that there's some kind of enforcement so that people don't have the opportunity to do stupid things in the woods.
Yeah, absolutely. That and also, logging equipment generates sparks. And so we've just got to get smarter about what we're doing in the woods during fire season, especially when we have high fire weather activity. And, just to point out a couple other issues, when we see big fires like this, they're mostly weather-driven events. High winds, hot temperatures, prolonged droughts, And in the case of both the Eagle Creek fire and the fires in Santa Rosa, we saw those exact conditions. And so the important message there is no amount of logging or so-called fuels reduction is going to either limit the occurrence of those fires or their intensity, because you've got such a strong climate effect that is operating on how those fires are moving through the landscape. Just to give you an example, the fires in Santa Rosa, my understanding is that they were burning across the landscape at about a rate of a football field every 3 to 4 seconds, mainly because of high winds that were coming in at about 50 miles an hour. And so, yeah, right, really, when you got those kinds of conditions, firefighters are really in harm's way. And it's another example of why we shouldn't be building in these fire-prone areas.
Now, something else you mentioned over a couple days ago, and I wondered if you were able to actually validate this, that you said that you had read somewhere, maybe in the New York Times, that one of the issues when they first were trying to start fighting the fires in California was that they had a lack of resources because the resources were allocated elsewhere, and you were surmising that they were allocated in wilderness areas fighting fires, perhaps the Checo Bar fire or some other fires in California. Did you find that? Is that really the case?
I think so. I think, you know, the firefighters, they're doing the best they can, and they're trying to save lives and property. And also, when we pull them away and we stick them in the wilderness areas, especially unsafe terrain, which was the case in at least the Checo Bar fire that was burning mainly in the Calmeopsis and some of the steepest terrain in the country, you don't want your firefighters in those conditions. You don't want them in harm's way, and we don't want to stretch our resources that are limited in those backcountry fires that are mostly beneficial. So I think we can do a lot with how we approach fire activity so that we're not trying to put out every single forest fire, which is a stress on the resources and the fires themselves, but we're actually working with fire in the backcountry instead of trying to put out every single fire.
Now, this is a conversation I remember 15 years ago during and after the Biscuit Fire, and it seems like it's been a conversation at least since the Yellowstone fires back in 1987. It seems like the fire service has, to some degree, changed their mode of operating around fire, and they're not quite as reactive to put every wildland fire, every backcountry fire out. But is there still, do you think, too much resources put into putting out backcountry fire, and that in this case there wasn't enough resources to deal with a fire that really needed to be put out around urban areas?
Well, I think you may have had a Freudian slip there, Barbara, called the Forest Service the Fire Service, but yeah, that's what they've become. I mean, their budget typically is more than half of their congressional allocation goes into firefighting, and, you know, the Forest Service is bipolar on this issue. They talk about the need to do more wildland fire for ecosystem benefits when fires are not burning, and then when you have a fire burning, they're under so much pressure from local officials, from the public, to put out the fire, that this is what stretches the resources, this is what gets firefighters in harm's way, and this is what the agency does, is go after mostly fires that are burning even under safe conditions. So what I'm arguing is that under safe conditions, when you don't have extreme fire weather, and when you're in the backcountry away from towns and homes, you need to work with those fires. And that doesn't mean let it burn. What it means is that you can compartmentalize a fire and you can allow it to burn safely in some conditions, monitor it, corral it, and set up your firefighting activities as point protection strategies so that you're steering the fire away from homes and communities and you're not hitting it with, you know, millions of dollars of suppression during times when fire weather is favorable for a nice, ecologically beneficial fire.
Well, I'm thinking back to 2002 and the Biscuit Fire, and one of the criticisms that was made was that the Forest Service let that fire burn too long, and that was a bad decision considering the fire ignited in the middle of July and turned out to be a very dry, hot year as well. What is your sense about that? Is that an accurate recollection, or did that fire face the same kind of aggressive confrontation that the Checo Bar fires faced?
I think so. And there were multiple lightning strikes that triggered that fire. And again, some of the steepest terrain in the country where you don't want to place firefighters in there. I mean, if my son or daughter was a firefighter, I would not want them in the Checo Bar fire area or the Calmeopsis wilderness trying to put that fire out. The Forest Service actually repelled two fire crews in, according to the incident command reports, and decided that they couldn't get them out safely. And so putting people in those conditions, whether it was the Biscuit or the Checo Bar fire, would not have helped, particularly given both the Biscuit and the Checo really picked up steam, so to speak, when there was extreme fire weather, hot temperatures. It was 115 degrees in the Illinois Valley this summer when that fire started spreading. Then you had the so-called Checo winds. Winds up to 40 miles an hour and higher were burning through or racing through those canyons. Those are unsafe conditions, and so we should not expect to put our precious lives at risk trying to put those fires out just to save a couple of home structures that were in the backcountry. Now, clearly, it got close to Brookings, and that's where you really set up your majority of your suppression activities.
Yeah, I remember in the Biscuit Fire, that I think that the Illinois Valley communities at Cave Junction and Selma were both evacuated at one point. And though none of those communities actually burned, but it seems like people get a little freaked out when the fire starts to move pretty close to towns. And so how do you balance that with not going full force and just trying to put the fire out totally?
Again, you know, I think the Forest Service has guidelines for when to fully suppress versus, you know, when to work with fire. And the first and most important guideline is not to put firefighters in harm's way. And then secondly, they have to weigh the benefits of the ecosystem beneficial effects of fire versus putting the fire out. And then thirdly, they got to look at structure and, you know, the resource itself. So they're juggling a lot of different factors when they decide which fires to fully suppress and which to really kind of corral and work with. And I try not to criticize the agency because, again, lives are the most important issue here. And if the incident commander is making a call that it's not safe to put somebody in a steep canyon area, then, you know, that's good enough for me. And I'm sorry that we all have to deal with the smoke, but I think human lives are the most important part of this.
So even if we're all complaining about the smoke, we have to, like, realize that this is a small price to pay for something that's of larger concerns.
Yeah, and I think, again, it gets back to the bigger issue here that, you know, we've built in the wrong places, and so eventually a fire is going to come through those places no matter what we do to stop the fire. So we really need to think about how can we get smarter about our development as we reset those communities and the existing homes, how do we reduce their fire risk? So instead of being in the backcountry trying to fight every single forest fire, maybe we need to put more resources into working with homeowners and educating them and working with them to reduce their fire risk at their home structure. I think that would be the best use of their limited resources.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dominic Della Sala, who's president and chief scientist at the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon. And we're talking about the extreme fire season that we are witnessing right now and ways that we have to come to terms with living with fire, which is both beneficial for the landscape, but also looks like it's increasing as we change our climate, which is what I want to get to next. Is how much of do you think that the fires, particularly the wine country fires in California right now, how much do you think that the intensity of these fires is due to climate change, and how much of it is just kind of flukes of meteorological conditions that all came together, in particular the fires igniting at a time when what they call the Diablo winds were blowing from the east?
Well, you know, I think, again, you can't really attribute any single fire to a climate event that's been going on for several decades. However, because I read the tea leaves, so to speak, on the latest science that's being done on climate change and how it's affecting Western forests in general, you know, we've got a pattern here that scientists are now saying at least half of the acres burning, the increases in acres burning, have a direct climate signal. That's half. of all the fires that we're seeing now have this direct climate signal.
Now, what does a climate signal mean?
It means that we're expecting to see these kinds of conditions as a result of increasing drought, higher temperatures, that will also result in the kind of wind effects that you get at the local and regional level. So it is consistent with the climate change that's affecting the wildfire season across the West. And, you know, here's a surprising fact that a lot of people may not realize. We actually have less fire burning today than we did in the early 1900s. The difference now is that we've got 46 million homes that are in fire sheds that are prone to fire events like what we're seeing in Santa Rosa. And so, again, you know, I keep coming back to this is a human problem. It's not a fire problem. And even though fires have been increasing recently because of a climate signal, we've got to figure out how to, A, leave more carbon in the ground by getting off of fossil fuels and not logging our forests because that releases carbon, and B, get smarter about where we build.
Well, one of the things that was very surprising for many people, ranging from lay people like me to actual scientists that I heard discussing, that there was very little expectation that this was going to be a bad fire year because there was so much moisture. I mean, we had 17 excessive inches of rain here in the northwest part of Oregon, and California was officially released from its five-year drought sometime in the late winter. You know, Jerry Brown declared the drought was over. And it turns out instead that all that wet weather that we had last winter actually, according to what I've been hearing, facilitated these fires to be so bad. So I want to talk a little bit about that dynamics. And this is the first time in my experience living on the West that I remember there being such a wet, cold, heavy snow, large snowpack year and having such a bad fire season.
During the late winter and early spring, I was jumping up and down, too, because we had all of this precipitation. We had a big snowpack year, and it looked like, you know, we were going to have enough water to get us through the dry summer. But it changed quickly. And so when we had that buildup of precipitation, we had a lot of plant growth, and then it dried out real quickly, and the temperatures heated up. So we had, you know, just about every year now, it seems like we get record summertime temperatures, and that was the case in many places of the West. And when you've got that kind of synergism between the climate and the regional effects, and you get a spark, now you're off to the races in terms of a very active fire season.
Now, is that, do you think, due to climate change that we had? Because here in Portland, we had one 100-degree day in June, and then actually it was a beautiful summer until July 31st, and then the heat really set in. I think in California and in, down your way, actually, the heat set in a little bit earlier. But it seemed to be, except for 2 years ago when we had a stretch of very hot days in June, and that was even a hotter, drier, worse fire season, it seems that there's something changing, and it is not anything that anybody who's lived in this area a long time remembers it ever being like. So I'm wondering, does that mean climate change has really taken, we're in the grips of climate change now?
Absolutely. I think we have entered a new climate fire era where everyone that has been here for a long time knows that things are changing. And, you know, we could get a year where we've got a lot of snowpack, but, you know, scientists look at trends. They don't look at just year-to-year variation. They look at long-term trends. And over the last 4 or 5 decades, we've seen a progressive decline in snowpack in the Western Cascades, a rapid increase in temperatures at about a 2-degree increase in the last few decades. And so when you look at that over long timelines, yeah, we definitely have climate change that is responsible for the changes that we see in our region, and it's associated with increased fire activity. So absolutely, we've entered a new era, and this is why I keep saying, and I said this in Congress last week, we cannot log our way out of this situation. Logging will not reduce fire activity. It's only going to make matters worse, especially when we combine with expanded growth in fire sheds and a changing climate. So we've got to solve both issues. We've got to solve for climate change, and we've got to solve for smart growth.
Well, there's like one other weird curve in terms of understanding the climate changes that's just happened. It's 2 feet of snow fell on Timberline Lodge a couple days ago. This is like the second week in October, and the ski season's starting. And this is after, I mean, when I was up on the Timberline Trail in the end of June last year, it was, I mean, I couldn't even get up there. I was on the Pacific Crest Trail, and it was snowed over in late June. So this is one of the shortest windows we've had of snow-free trails in Mount Hood and probably and a lot of other peaks in the Cascades. So what does this mean? I mean, it was, and I wonder how this, I mean, for us here in Oregon, fire season is probably effectively over because it's starting to snow so much in the mountains. It doesn't affect what's going on in California, but I wonder how you interpret this, having this very small window of a fire season and yet it being so devastating.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, you look at interannual variation, that is a change from one year to the next. You could have a very dense snowpack in any given year. But when you look at it over decades of data sets, which, you know, have been used to track snowpack, you can see that there's been a progressive decline in snowpack, and the snow is melting earlier in the season, not lasting as long. And that all affects fire activity. It affects when the plants are drying out and the length of the fire season.
So I want to talk some more about people actually protecting their homes, the steps that people can take to make their homes more fire resistant. And one thought I had is when you talk about clearing the vegetation for like 50 feet around the house, the reason why people move into the woods and into these canyons is because they want to be surrounded by trees and nature and forests. So if they are going to have to clear what's basically the size of a Portland lot, it's a rather large area to be clearing for vegetation, do you think that would make this kind of landscape less attractive to people and maybe people would move back to cities?
It might. And, you know, I used to live in a fire shed and I had these beautiful madrone trees surrounding my house. And what I did in that situation is I didn't want to chop down my madrone trees. I made sure that none of the branches were touching the roof. I also pruned all the low branches so that there was nothing for fire to race up into the canopy. I made sure I had no flammable shrubs or flammable grasses around my house. And I had pretty good fire defensible space. So I think you can work with a number of different options. Ideally, you want to reduce the tree canopy to about 40% or lower. So you can still have some trees, but it definitely is not a good idea to have to be in a dense forest situation with lots of low branches on your trees and grasses, because those are the exact conditions that will just carry a fire from the ground into the tree canopy and right on top of your roof.
So I wonder how you really develop consciousness amongst people who are living in these situations. I visited this woman about 3-4 years ago who lives in the woods, up in the mountains above Missoula, and it's a beautiful place. She built this log cabin, and they were burning some. I think we're losing you again, Dominique. Anyway,
I'm still here.
Okay, good. Okay, so when I came up to her place, they were burning some brush and stuff, and I made some comment about if they were doing some fire protection. And I was looking around, and there are trees everywhere. And I asked her how defensible her property was, and she gave me this look like, I really don't want to think about that. She knew there's an issue there, but it was kind of like talking to people about the 9.0 earthquake that's going to hit Oregon at some point. It's very hard to get people to wrap their brains around it. So how do we get people to take it really seriously? I'm hoping that the fires in the wine country are going to make people take it more seriously, but it is still a thing of thinking, well, that won't happen to me.
Yeah, I think, you know, we need to work more with homeowners. I think California's done a decent job. They've got laws that say you've got to have defensible space. It's not often enforced. There's an enforcement problem. And if you don't have defensible space, then you have liability issues that come up. You know, you're liable for the outbreak of that fire event. So I think we got to look at that. We got to work with insurance companies that give breaks to homeowners that do defensible space and charge higher rates for those that don't. And so I think we got to look at more responsibility of every single homeowner that lives in these conditions needs to take on the responsibility of reducing their fire risk. Otherwise, they're a liability to their surrounding neighbors.
I actually read an interview with a first responder who was talking about how when they were basically doing triage about which houses they were going to try to protect around Santa Rosa, and the houses that were had defensible space, they went after first, and there were some houses that where they considered not protecting them at all because there was no defensible space. And I got the sense that, well, it was a hard choice to make, and wherever possible, they would try to put the fires out on that house. But it sounded like it's really hard to really bite the bullet and say to people, if you don't have defensible space around your house is toast if there's a fire.
It is, but you know, you got to be responsible, because then you're setting up a situation where you're putting firefighters' lives at risk. You know, these houses that are in steep canyon country where you can't even turn around a fire engine, those are unsafe places, and that's irresponsible development, in my opinion, because you're putting people's lives at risk.
So do you see a possibility of there being land use laws? In Oregon, it's pretty hard to build in most of those places because they're not zoned for development. I mean, there are some exceptions, but by and large, there's far fewer developments like that than there are in California, but California is riddled with them. Is it time to get people to move out of those places? I mean, people who've lost their homes in Napa and Sonoma County, should they not be allowed to rebuild in places where it's absolutely indefensible? I mean, it's different from like these tracts that were just destroyed in the northern edges of Santa Rosa. I mean, there it's a different story. Even there, I think there were some issues where people hadn't taken very good measures to make their houses defensible.
I think so, and I think, you know, we face the same situation, whether or not, you know, people are living in Hurricane Alley in the southeastern United States or flood-prone regions that are going to see increasing floods because of climate change. I think it's the same thing with the fire issue in the West and these places that are going to experience more fire activity because of climate change. You know, just rebuilding them in the same exact places, recognizing that at some point in the near future, they're going to have another fire event. It just doesn't seem like smart growth to me. And it's just setting up the situation for a spiraling increase in the amount of fire suppression costs, which is what we're going through right now. Forest Service spends annually about $2 billion on fire suppression, more than half of their total budget. That is only going to increase no matter where we get the money from, as we continue to build in these fire-prone fire sheds.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dominic Della Sala, who's president and chief scientist at the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon. We're talking about the very virulent wildfire season that we're witnessing right now, and kind of tipped off by the fires that are going on right now in wine country in California. Besides taking away vegetation that grows close to the house, what else can people do to make their actual structures more fire resilient?
Yeah, there's a lot of great information online that people can access. If you just plug in defensible space or home protection zone, you'll get a whole kind of list of ways to reduce your risk. And as I mentioned, you know, pruning your trees so that there are no branches touching the home, making sure that you built your roof with fire-resistant material, not wood shingles. Make sure that you screen off any open vents, because that's how embers will ignite. Make sure you screen your gutters so that needles and leaves don't hang out in the gutters during the dry portion of the season. And reducing the flammable vegetation, make sure you don't have any firewood close to your deck. And I think if you do all of that, then the chances that your house will get through a fire event really go way up. I mean, there's no way you can guarantee any particular home won't burn, but you can certainly much improve your odds that your house will not burn if you do proper defensible space management.
I was just thinking about this friend of mine who lived in the Rock Ridge section of Oakland back in 1991 when the Oakland Hills caught fire. And actually, the fire went about a block from her house. It stopped a block from her house. And she was describing to me how one of her roommates, when the fire started, before they evacuated, he went and cut down all the eucalyptus trees on the block and all the fences, all the cedar fences. He just went crazy with a chainsaw. And she thinks that's probably what saved their houses. But that seems like something that a lot of people are not going to want to do, is not have those cedar fences. And unfortunately, a lot of people in California like those eucalyptus trees.
I know, and that's the issue that we face. So we have built these communities in fire sheds that are going to burn at some point, and we are surrounding these homes with flammable vegetation. So it's really set this situation up for the kinds of disasters that we have just seen in Santa Rosa. And I think if you keep doing this over and over again, then it becomes crazy, right?
So how much do you worry about? I mean, I'm because one of the things that I've been thinking about is, you know, how common could this become that cities would go up in smoke, in flames, like Santa Rosa, that are close, that are in fire sheds and that are close to wildlands that can catch fire? It seems very unlikely in the Willamette Valley and in the Cascades around here in the Coast Range because it's so wet, though that could change. But I wonder down in Southern Oregon where you are if you have some concerns of a similar fire potentially torching ashland.
I think so. And, you know, there's work going on in the Ashland watershed to reduce fire risks. And I think the best way to deal with this is to work on defensible space and making sure every single house in the Ashland fire shed is equipped to handle an eventual fire event. Because, as I mentioned, we can do all kinds of thinning away from the house, but that is not going to change the odds of that house burning at all. And so the best way to deal with the eventuality of a fire event in those communities is defensible space. Logging in the backcountry will not change those odds.
Well, in the last part of the show, I want to talk about some about the beneficial aspects of the Eagle Creek fire, and then talk about how we confront Congressman Walden and his desire to salvage log the guts out of our remaining beautiful forest. So first, let's talk about some of the footage that you've seen and some of that you sent me of aerial views of the Columbia Gorge after the fire and what it shows us.
Okay, well, first of all, a fire in the gorge is not an unnatural event. However, the way it started was certainly unnatural. But the last fire that occurred in the gorge, I believe, was in 1904. And it burned over a very large region of the Western Cascades in a very similar pattern as what we are seeing now with the aftermath of the Eagle Creek fire. And, you know, if I could just take away the human element and realize no one told me, you know, how the fire started, and just looking at the flyovers, I see a very ecologically beneficial fire. It burned in a nice mosaic pattern. There were some large and small patches of severe fire where most of the trees were killed. But by and large, that was a low to moderate severity fire event. And when we look at that kind of pattern of fire intensities at a landscape scale, I see all kinds of wildlife habitat in that fire. And eventually some of those big trees are going to fall over into the watersheds. And now you are restoring salmon habitat. So that fire could be very beneficial to plants and animals in the Columbia River Gorge. The real catastrophe is what Representative Greg Walden is talking about. And if he's successful, you know, people will be driving through the gorge. Instead of viewing a beautiful landscape that is rejuvenating from fire, you'll see very large clear cuts that Greg Walden wants to have on Oregon's Columbia River Gorge.
So how do we stop that?
Well, we've got to start putting pressure on Congress to get rationale about how to deal with the aftermath of fire, and that in no way should we be talking about logging in a national scenic area that also has wilderness overlapping in it. So I would encourage folks to call their representatives, particularly Greg Walden, and call our senators and just say, look, you got to stop this legislation because this is bad for Oregon's economy, as this scenic area is, you know, as a job-generating and economic resource for Oregon. We don't want to see clear cuts in it. And that forest is doing just fine in the aftermath of the fire. That's not the catastrophe. This logging bill would be the catastrophe.
Now, I'm not positive about this. I am vaguely remembering that Kurt Schrader is also co-sponsoring the bill. Is that correct?
I believe so.
So, I mean, we've got three of our Oregon delegation who I'm sure are agree with us and are not going to support the bill, and probably both of our senators. But it seems like it's, and I was talking about this actually last week when I talked with Brett Burden, Vandenhelfel from Columbia Riverkeeper, and there's a lot of listeners that we have who live in either Kurt Schrader's or Greg Walden's districts. And so I'm hoping that you listeners, because you have more clout than those of us who live in the other districts, to really get on the phone with your representatives and let them know just how detrimental this bill could be.
That would be great. And, you know, there's all kinds of online resources. There are local groups that are fighting this. The group BARC is fighting it. Oregon Wild is fighting it. So I think folks can get active if they don't want to call their representative, you know, work with those conservation groups that are defending our precious public lands.
Well, I think it's been very interesting how quickly that bill came up, and that in the beginning, I mean, this was just days after the fire. I think BARC came out with a statement that was saying basically that the fire was much needed, that the gorge needed, that the fire is part of its natural landscape, and basically saying what you're saying now. It was very hard for people to hear that, like on September 7th or 8th, and maybe it, with the timing of BARC saying it in that way, was not the greatest to get support. But I've been noticing more and more groups have been saying that in the last few weeks, and of course, as soon as Walden introduced his legislation, a lot of people are saying it. So I wonder how we balance the feelings of the fact that there's still kind of an outrage, I think, that people feel that the way that fire was started, and how do we come to a point where we recognize that despite how it was started, it is beneficial, and the least beneficial thing would be for Greg Walden to have his way.
Yeah, this is the toughest issue I've ever worked on in my 30-plus years of working on forest issues, because, you know, there's such a big human element here. It's the health issue with smoke, and then it's the visual issue. But, you know, I had a real interesting experience with this on a personal level. I had just finished a book on rainforest, and I thought at that time I knew what a forest was. It was verdant, it was old growth, and it wasn't until my 8-year-old and I were hiking in a burned landscape close to Ashland, and we stopped for lunch on this beautiful scenic overview looking down into Ashland, and right in front of us was this huge patch of all tree killed forest. And during our lunch, that place was alive. It had butterflies, it had woodpeckers, it had dragonflies, all kinds of plants were coming back. It was a snag forest with just prolific wildlife. And I thought to myself, I need to recalibrate what my understanding of a forest is. And if an 8-year-old can get it, then maybe a member of Congress can get it. And, you know, the point of that visual is that time since fire matters. And while it may look initially as devastation, if you come back a year, 3 years, 5 years after the fire, it's incredibly rich with wildlife. And the wildlife in the snag forest rivals that of the more herald old-growth forest. It's just underappreciated because people don't have the patience to come back and actually look at how the forest has rejuvenated itself. It's remarkable.
Well, actually, this weekend I climbed Hamilton Mountain out in the gorge. It was the first time I was hiking in the gorge since the fire. And I remember that was the very first hike I ever took when I moved to Oregon. And when I went up to the top of Hamilton Mountain in 1972, there was a big patch of burn. It was a very large burn, which from my eyes as a transplanted New Englander was very disconcerting. I tried to find that burn, and this is now like 45 years later. There's no sign of it, of course. It looks like it's one of the probably the healthier part of the forest was where that burn was back in the early 70s. So it's again, and then I look across the river and see the burns from the Eagle Creek fire and think about how that will come back too.
Exactly. And, you know, this is why, you know, I worked on this book that was subtitled Nature's Scenics with 27 other scientists. We've seen the same thing over and over again, whether it's in the western United States or other places that have these mixed intensity fire events in a forest system. If we just give these landscapes enough time and enough love, they do quite well in the aftermath of a fire. They're not ecological catastrophes. The real catastrophe is what Greg Walden is talking about.
Well, Dominic, it's always good to talk to you, and we will check in again in a few months and see where we're at with this fire landscape that we're living in right now. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, Barbara.
We've been talking this morning with Dominic Della Sala, who's president and chief scientist at the Geos Institute in Ashland, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you just are tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk more about wildfire with Peter Cornelison, who's with Friends of the Gorge, and also I think he's a city councilman in Hood River, and Cynthia Winter, who had to evacuate from her home in Corbett during the early days of the Eagle Creek fire. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening. I had a dream.